Welcome back to Listening to the Dead, Season 2. More crimes, more forensics, more revelations. This is Episode 1, Blunt Force.
Hello and welcome to the second season of Listening to the Dead. I'm John Watt, and for this season, I'm lucky enough to be joining the Queen of Crime, novelist, producer, screenplay writer, and of course, podcaster, Linda LaPlante, reunited with everybody's favourite ex-copper, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force, Kaz Sutherland. Hello both, thanks for letting me crash your crime team.
Hi there.
Hiya, thanks.
Linda, I mean, it's been about a year since we last recorded Series 1. What have you been up to in lockdown?
Writing, writing and writing. And strangely enough, you know, my last Tennyson book is called Blunt Force. So it's kind of very much connected to what we'll be talking about. But I've found the lockdown for me, you know, the ability to just have no interruptions and write is the way I live my life, really. And so it's been a very productive time, albeit at times exceedingly boring.
So this is episode one, and we're looking at blunt force homicide. But as a theme, this whole series is looking at the cause of death. Six episodes, six causes of death, and how they're investigated. I was going to come to you there, Linda, on when you start out and you're thinking of your plot and you're planning your novel. I'm just interested where cause of death comes in, like, because it must be quite a useful plot device where you're saying, okay, so if he's shot, then there's distance. If it's blunt force, then it's up close. Are these important things for you to decide early on in plotting a novel?
Absolutely, because your plot kicks off with the murder. You know, the call out to the police, we've found a body, be they in a fire, whatever. There's so many different varieties. And I've always, you know, concentrated on the murder and getting the facts right as fast as I can. But the police inquiry is often lagging behind it. They have to. And what they're doing is usually, after the body is found, is the police, and I know Cass will absolutely verify all this, is where did the body come from? Who is it related to? How can it be identified? They're building those facts whilst the post-mortem is taking place. Then you've got the post-mortem, and then you can say, and actually in my novel, Blunt Force, there were three massive blows to the victim's head. Which blow came first, which was secondary, and even a third blow. And this was quite a lengthy process to be able for the pathologist to say, the two minor blows did not kill him. It was the third big blow would have made him unconscious. So that brings me into who gave the first blow to the victim, who gave the second blow, how did it happen, what was the weapon, and in this case it was a cricket bat. And then it even went further in the book, Blunt Force, because he was disemboweled. So which came first? This is all part of plotting out the very big opening sequence to drive the plot forward.
Absolutely. We can ask Stuart all of this later and find out his conclusion. Ooh, yes. Cass, from a detective's perspective, what is the importance of cause of death? Is it the first thing you're looking to establish at the scene? And after the fact, I suppose, that the person is dead. But where does it come in your investigation when you're arriving at a scene?
For me, it comes a bit lower down the scale. I mean, it's obviously very important, particularly when you're dealing with question mark, suspicious death. Have I got a murder here or haven't I? But the main priority for me was always about, you know, taking a step back and looking at what's in front of me and thinking how I can best preserve evidence and what might be vital evidence that can get us an early lead. And at the same time, you have to be, while you're aware of that, you have to think about the other experts you may want to call in. But my main priority would be to, I'd want to clear a path to the scene. So any evidence that's there before I can get to the body, once everything's been photographed, of course, and videoed, I want to clear that so then I can let the pathologists in or the SIO if they want to go in. But it's interesting. I don't know if Stuart has the same experiences. But when I moved into becoming a CSI, I found that that SIOs and detectives were all, what's the cause of death? We need to know, what's the cause of death? What's the cause of death? And you try and say, well, actually, there's a lot more important things before we get to that. I know it sounds a bit macabre, but, you know, the body's dead. It's not going anywhere. So what's the rush? You need to take your time, because if you make mistakes, you know, you could end up with somebody who's guilty getting off. You can end up contaminating the scene. So all those things need to be aware of before you actually even know the cause of death. Sometimes it's pretty obvious. You know, if there's a knife in the body or there's a hammer stuck in the head, you kind of know that that's probably what it is. But even then, suspicious death, the adage is always think murder until the investigation proves otherwise.
Yeah, that's so important, isn't it? You're right. The patience that's needed to not trample all over it in your haste to get to the body. Okay, so this episode is all about blunt force homicide. I was just looking for things to sort of suggest how prevalent this is in society. I've found some stats, but one of them is, of course, that 3 of the 6 causes of death in the game Cluedo are blunt force homicide, which nicely sort of sums up its prevalence in as a form of homicide. It's the second most common homicide in the UK, accounting for about 23% of homicides last year. But it's also, I think Stuart may correct me when we get to Stuart, but it's one of the most difficult for forensics teams. You know, what sort of weapon was used, which blow killed the victim? It can be quite a messy scene, I imagine. Let's talk to Stuart. Here to help sift us through the evidence is Stuart Hamilton. We're welcoming back from Series 1. He's the Chief Forensic Pathologist at East Midlands Pathology Unit. Hello, Stuart.
Good day.
Good day. In Series 1, we were talking about the job of a pathologist with you. Now we're getting more granular and looking specifically at causes of death. Could you give us sort of a quick summary of what the term blunt force homicide would cover for you?
So blunt force homicide covers virtually anything that isn't sharp. So if it's not a knife, it's something blunt, be that a fist, a boot, a baseball bat, a crowbar, a hammer. These are all blunt force traumas, and these have serious effects on the body.
Kaz, when you were investigating, how common was blunt force homicide?
I'm undoubtedly probably the most common. In the sense of a fight. The Friday night drinkers, out they go. They have an argument, one punch, somebody goes down, they smash their head on the pavement or on a wall, and they have hematomas, but I'll leave Stuart to explain all that, and they die. Even a push, I've known people who've simply been pushed, and they fall over and they bang their head, and that happens. Yes, of course, with weapons and that, we had cases where there were many, many different types of weapons used, but as I say, It would be the Friday, Saturday night punch up.
So it's you know, it is a crime of passion, a momentary lapse of reason, a blunt force homicide, really. It's a sort of crude crime. Does that make it easier to investigate, Cass?
No, actually, it depends how you describe passion. Because if you take rage, for example, you take rival gangs, they go armed with, not just knives or guns, there's baseball bats, crowbars, and it's sheer rage. You know, I'm trying to prove one's better than the other. Yes, in domestic circumstances, I would say most often it was just a sudden loss of temper. For example, I had a husband who was doing some DIY, had an argument with his wife. toolbox was on the floor next to him, and he picked up the hammer, only hit it once, and that was that. So those kind of things, yeah, they do happen, yeah.
I mean, what I find interesting is that the use of, you know, blunt force. When there was that big case with Lord Lucan, all the newspapers described the death of Sandra Rivett, who was the nanny for Lord Lucan's children. And they always describe it as bludgeoned to death, which is, I mean, I don't know, Stuart, if you think that it's gone from, you know, describing death by blunt force to from bludgeoned to blunt force. Is that a more common use now than it used to be?
I think bludgeoned is very much more press speak than expert speak. It sounds good for a headline. We these days try to keep things as neutral as possible, to the extent whereby if we're not sure whether it's a blow or a fall, we will simply say impact. So as an expert, we try to keep things as non-judgmental as possible, because it's not our job to decide how it was done or whether it was in rage or passion. It's simply that it occurred.
So I think Lord Lucan's an interesting one there to bring up, Linda, because if I remember, it was a sort of, it was a Cluedo-like lead piping. Yes. That she was hit with, but they could never, the forensics, I seem to remember, couldn't prove that the lead pipe in his boot was the one used, in the boot of his car was the one used.
Did they find one in the basement as well?
Yes, I think there was one in the basement, one in the boot of the car, but they couldn't join them together or show that they came from the same pipe.
And they were wrapped with like plaster wrapping round one end, which is almost the old kind of a weapon that no leave fingerprints on a plaster wrapped around an iron bar.
An interesting one to put to Stuart there. So that was early 70s. Mm. What's moved on in sort of 40 years? Would change so much now looking at a piece of lead piping in the basement?
I think Cass will be able to deal with this just as well as I can. But I mean, sort of the first thing that shouts at you is DNA. In those days, that simply was science fiction. The advances in forensic science, the advances in trace evidence recovery, and a lot of those very important things about those initial moments that Cass was talking about. When you have somebody who has been bludgeoned around the head, yes, the post-mortem is going to give you detail, how many blows, what sort of object, what sort of force. But that core principle that the person has been hit on the head is fairly clear. And therefore, it's the scene at that point and that evidence recovery that has really advanced and really become a big part of the investigation, much more than the pathologist simply wandering in, flicking his cigarette ash around as he goes and going, yeah, been hit on the head.
I could bet you at the Lord Lucan scene, I could bet you half of the top brass at Scotland Yard went there to have a look to it. I mean, I should just see it now, you know, because that's, well,
yeah.
Unfortunately, that was just the way it was in those days.
Yeah, we've even moved to the point these days that sometimes we are, I wouldn't say unwelcome, but probably not the best people to be at the scene, because all we are is an extra body to contaminate it, to stand there and go, I'll tell you what I really think after the autopsy. So often photographs of the scene, the body in situ, is sufficient for us to know where we're working and to leave all the other ologists to do their work uninterrupted, and then we come in when we're needed.
Under what circumstances are you called to the scene?
We will sometimes get called to the scene, particularly in those cases that are on a bit of a knife edge, where it's 50-50 whether this is likely to be a suspicious death or whether it's likely to be a simple fall or trip. So I think those ones where it's not clear, our initial examination and opinion can be helpful. And usually for the pathologist, it's just to see the body in context. So seeing what's around, what the blood patterns are like, how much blood is there, it just starts informing you as to what are going to be the major issues when you examine the body in more detail.
So if we take sort of this idea of a blunt force homicide, is it a blow to the head we're talking about that normally causes the death here?
By far and away, the most common are the blows to the head. As Cass made reference to, there's the one punch cases where somebody simply loses their temper, punches somebody in a pub or outside a pub, they go down, they hit the head and they're dead. But with other forms of blunt force, then the head is usually where people direct their blows if they're intending to cause serious harm, because the head is vulnerable.
I always thought the skull was designed, sort of evolution designed it to protect this vital organ, the brain. But you're saying it's a vulnerable point.
You're correct in that the skull protects the brain under the vast majority of normal circumstances that a human being is exposed to. But at the same time, the skull is a solid bony box. And if you get increased pressure in your head for whatever reason, with blunt force trauma usually bruising around the brain and brain swelling, then it actually harms the brain because the brain is contained and can't escape and gets essentially crushed.
It occurs to me that sometimes it must be difficult to be able to tell between what is deliberate and what is accidental trauma from blunt force.
It can be very difficult. The simple fact of normal day-to-day life is that blunt trauma is common. People bump their shins, they fall over. And really, you're looking at, first of all, the overall distribution of injuries. Are they widely distributed on the body, or are they focused, say, on the head? And also, you're more likely to bump a bony prominence. So a shin, an elbow, a knee are more likely to be accidentally injured. Somewhere that's much less prominent, like the small of the back, is much more likely to be an inflicted trauma. We sometimes talk about the hat brim rule line with head injuries. If you imagine somebody wearing an old-fashioned trilby, then injuries that are above where the brim of the hat are very likely to be inflicted by someone else. Injuries below that may be accidental or inflicted.
What sort of marks are you looking for then when you're examining this body and you know that it's been a blunt force homicide? What sort of traces are you looking for there to show you what was the weapon used?
You're looking for particularly splits to the skin, you're looking for the size and the shape of it. And that is often the thing that tells you what you need to know, the shape of that injury. If you've got a linear injury, a long linear one, it's probably something rod-like. It's your pipe, your lead pipe. If you've got a lovely crescent with a bit of grazing, you're looking for a hammer. If it's maybe just a little star-like mark on the back of the head, then you're thinking it's a fall to the ground. So those shapes are immediately starting to direct you to what sort of implement or weapon you're thinking about.
Stuart, do you immediately, if you have a victim that has possibly blunt force killed him, do you immediately shave the head?
It would be very common to do that very early on after the trace evidence has been taken. It is surprising for those who are fortunate enough to have a full head of hair quite how much that can cover up. So yes, shave the head is quite a common process that we go through. Personally, I tend to try and avoid the front of the head simply for the purposes of viewing afterwards for the family. Particularly if you have a lady who's got long, luscious hair, you're trying to balance the forensic evidence and what is needed for the prosecution with what the family are going to have to deal with afterwards.
That's fascinating.
Sorry, if we take Linda's case earlier from her recent book, Blunt Force, you've got a number of different blows by a number of different implements, and the question was which one killed the victim. How do you approach that? I mean, what are the layers of evidence you have to peel back?
It is very literally a peeling back. So it is looking at the surface of the body, the skin, and then you will physically peel that off, and you're looking at the outside of the skull. You're looking at the fractures and fracture patterns. It's then opening the skull itself and looking at what bleeding there is on and around the brain. As Linda quite rightly said, things take time. In a case like that, the brain will go to a neuropathologist for their expert comment on the precise damage to the brain, and that will take 8 to 12 weeks if you've got a good, efficient neuropathologist. You may be sending parts of the skull to a bone pathologist to look at the fractures and how old they are, and you're looking at the actual distribution of the fractures. We work on what's called Pupé's rule, which is that fractures tend not to cross an old fracture line. The force is dissipated when they reach a previous fracture. So you're trying to get an idea of what order things may have occurred in. The locations will tell you about what effects they may have. And it's putting that all together as a great big whole to try and get to the real detail of what's happened to this person.
So, Stuart, you could say that if you have a victim with blunt force, did you just say that there could be underlying previous indentations on the skull that could actually prove that this was somebody that had suffered abuse over a lengthy period, and then the one blow on top of it was the fatal one?
That is certainly something that can be seen. If you have a healing fracture, then it will be apparent, and the bone pathologists will be able to see the changes in that fracture. But equally, if you have three blows in quick succession, the fracture pattern will tell you, if the fracture lines aren't crossing, in what order they occurred, even in that sort of acute, sudden, violent incident. And equally, sort of older brain damage will be apparent on the neuropathology. So you can build up a picture of not just the person's immediate death, but things that have occurred to them in the months and potentially years leading up to it.
Is it possible for there to be a delayed death after a blow to the head then? I mean, will it be difficult then to ascertain when the blow was made and what made it, if it's much later?
A delayed death is common. Often with a blow to the head, you will get relatively slow bleeding around the brain, which can take up to a number of hours to actually cause somebody to collapse and die. It's called a lucid interval. That can be incredibly difficult for the investigators, because particularly if you have someone who is assaulted, then you have a period of 3-4 hours where their movements are unaccounted for. You know that one of the defence's arguments is going to be, well, could something have happened in the interim that actually caused that bleed, caused that damage? And head injuries can have an ongoing effect for many years. I think the longest I've seen between the assault injuring the head and death where they were prosecuting was about 17 years.
Wow. Gosh, that's a plot writing itself, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it would be hard to bring a murder investigation 17 years after. That's a long time. Which do you think of all the cases that you have worked on was the most difficult?
The most difficult was actually probably that one, because the causation arguments got very, very complicated. It's clear that this man was assaulted, somebody was convicted of it, and he was never right again, and then he was dead. But because of the really big lag in time, actually proving that causation was very challenging. in a sense, for the pathologist, very clear. The end point was what you get from being immobile, and he was immobile because of the head injury. But so many questions to answer about care and time, it was quite interesting.
Very, very interesting. It feels like there are some blurred lines here between what is homicide and what is manslaughter, particularly with blunt force trauma. I mean, how easy is it to get to the truth of what happened with this? Whether because if the blow wasn't intended to kill, then is it manslaughter or is it still murder?
The interesting thing that is the law on what is murder, and that is that if someone intends to cause really serious harm, i.e. a grievous bodily harm level offence, and the person dies, that is murder, which is actually easier to prove, believe it or not, than attempted murder. Because in attempted murder, the law says you have to prove the intent was to kill, not just to harm. So it's a very interesting little corner for the experts.
It's very narrow, though, isn't it?
Very narrow.
Stuart, you spoke there about the skull earlier, and it protecting the brain, but the brain then swells inside. Are all skulls created equal? I mean, what if one skull is not as thick, and therefore the blow kills when it might not have killed somebody else? Do you see that?
No, absolutely. All skulls are not the same in the same way that not everybody is the same build. Not everybody has big shoulders or long legs. Some skulls are thinner than others and therefore are more prone to fracturing, are less protective. This has been through the courts, and it's actually referred to as the thin skull defence, in that the defence was, well, if he'd had a normal skull, he wouldn't have died of that injury. And this is where the principle that's often trotted out of you take your victim as you find them came from, that the ruling was, well, it's not that person's fault, they have a thin skull, and you still assaulted them. So it's still your fault.
Could a blow to the chin, Stuart, have the same effect as a blunt force punch or bang on the head?
In short, yes, a blow to the jaw can certainly kill you. What happens is your head twists on your neck, and the small arteries that run up the vertebra, called the vertebral arteries, can tear. And that causes what's called a traumatic basal subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is bleeding around the base of your brain and your brainstem. And that is one of the things, actually, that we see that drops people dead.
Wow.
Like that. So, yes, a glancing blow to the jaw, particularly if you've got a good twist on the head, can certainly kill people and kill people instantaneously.
Interestingly, on that, there, Stuart, I had a case with a 15-year-old girl whose body was found some months after she disappeared. And, of course, it was badly decomposed. To cut a long story short, at the end of the day, we found a young man who was 16 years of age. And the day before court, he came out with the story that I was swinging a snooker cue around in my hand. She was sat in my bedroom. It slipped out and it hit her in the back of the head. And she fell to the ground. The pathologist had to say, it's a million to one, but it could happen. I cannot say it cannot happen. He got found guilty of manslaughter.
Yes, and the Australian cricketer, was it Hughes, who collapsed on the field? That was an unfortunate blow, damaging that artery. So cricket ball, not enough neck protection. It is always amazing to the pathologist what some people survive that you think you couldn't possibly survive, and sometimes how easily the most innocent or trivial appearing impact ends up with a body on my slab.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because you're essentially saying it's very difficult to ever generalize about how much force is needed to kill a person.
That's right. It's force and its location. So a blow to the front of the skull where the bone is nice and thick and firm and not likely to fracture will often be relatively safe. A blow to the temple with much less force can lead to extradural bleeding and death.
I can see Linda feeling her skull at the moment.
I know, I don't know if this is the right time to even bring it up, but right now we have all this discussion about footballers. And I mean, they're hitting, that football weighs a ton. Yeah. And, you know, they're bringing up that it's the cause of Alzheimer's or dementia in so many footballers. But the reality is constant pressure at that point in your skull has to create some kind of problem eventually, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's repetitive minor trauma that's the problem with that. So each time you head the ball, it'll just rattle your brain a little bit inside your skull. It's very similar to boxers in the past with what they call dementia pugilistica. Yes. It's that repeated minor trauma that causes probably not enough damage for you to notice at the time, but if you do it again and again and again, it accumulates and that overall damage to the brain eventually manifests.
What are the sort of trends in blunt force homicide? I was reading a stat from the ONS which said that until 1980, blunt force homicide tended to be fairly even between the sexes, the victim. Whereas after 1980, it's been a lot more male on male. Is that something you saw, Kaz?
Yes, I know there were more, but I can only think of two or three cases personally, certainly two as a CSI, and maybe a couple of others when I was a detective during 30 years, where women had used a weapon against a man. One was in a hammer. But interestingly, in both cases, it was more spur of the moment. One had been lying in bed asleep and woke up and the chap was touching her. And she, the question was, because she went out of the room and grabbed the hammer and then came back in, then she hit him a few times with a hammer. But yeah, it was predominantly the men. I'm actually surprised that Stuart might be able to answer. I don't know if there are many women who died of it, because...
Strangely enough, still outside the domestic homicides, it is far less common. I don't know why that is. I tend to only know about what comes across my desk or my colleagues, but certainly the vast majority of cases that we see of blunt force homicides is man on man or man on woman. Very few female perpetrators that I can recall at the moment. I've seen a few ladies stabbing men over the last few years, but very few sort of straightforward blunt homicides.
So would you say that there's not so much use of DNA for you working on a blunt force victim, is there?
No, DNA is much less useful in those sorts of cases, because quite often, certainly if you have the domestics, the perpetrator has access to the defendant, the deceased. And with our modern culture, which I pass no comment upon, a lot of these pub fights and things are captured on CCTV. There is no question as to who punched him and where he lands. DNA is an incredibly powerful tool for the people who say, I wasn't there, or where you simply have no idea who the perpetrator is. If you can get DNA for the perpetrator or somebody who's been in contact with that person and potentially match it, then you're well on your way to finding who did it.
Picking up what Stuart said there, when you're dealing with the body, you need to be really careful how you're transporting it, because I have known cases where we were able to use different light sourcing on a body, on the head, and we actually found some of the letters of Adidas. A couple of them actually imprinted on the head by using specialist lighting. So we know right away we're looking for somebody who was wearing Adidas trainers. It's also possible, difficult, but it is possible to get a footprint off. You can't see with a human eye off a T-shirt. So all those things you have to consider when you're at the scene. Well, should I remove that top here and now in the best way possible to box it so that I can preserve it so I don't damage whatever may be on there? So I don't know if you've had any personal cases like that, Stuart.
I've had a few, and I think it highlights two very important things. Firstly, if you compare what you're saying to the Lord Lucan case, you know, the vast armamentarium we have now of tools to look at these things, the vast increase in the importance of them, and also, once again, how it has become so much more of a collaborative process. So the 1950s, 1960s, again, with the pathologist wandering in with his cigarette going off, I'll do everything here, you know, is long gone. We are one of the cogs in the wheel of getting those answers, but we have to be aware of what other people can do and when we should be stepping back and allowing them to do that properly. I always argue that my job starts at the skin and works in. If it's outside, if it's clothing, if it's, you know, anything on the body or around the body, there is another ologist who is good at that. I start at the skin and I move towards the middle of the body.
Yeah, in that way, how more difficult it is if you have a very decomposed victim brought to you where the frame and skin has already gone. Is that a by far more difficult process for you to work on?
It is far more difficult, and in some cases we do end up having to say, I'm sorry, I can't get anywhere with this. I was fortunate or unfortunate enough to work on the Witcherly case, which was an elderly couple who were shot by their daughter and son-in-law. They had been buried for about 18 years, I think, and they were pretty much skeletons. But when we examined them and identified where the bullets were found, it was possible to show that given the location of the gunshot wounds and the damage to the skeleton, that they must have been fatal gunshot wounds. One was lodged right in the spine, in front of, behind where the aorta would have been, and therefore logically it must have passed through the aorta, and therefore we were able to get a murder conviction.
Can you tell anything about the perpetrator by the choice of weapon or the method of murder they choose to employ, do you think? I mean, like, it occurs to me that, you know, strangulation, blunt force trauma, they're quite personal. You have to get up close and personal to someone. Do you think this reveals something about them?
I think on the basis of what we've been talking about how people survive and how people don't, I think with blunt trauma, if you're intending for somebody to be dead, it has to be repeated. And that takes time and it is physically demanding. And so I often half jokingly say to my trainees, if you hit somebody once, I think many people will have done that at some point in their lives in anger. Twice, you could be cross. By the time you've hit somebody twice, particularly with an implement, and you're getting up to the third blow, you've got time to go, oh, I lost control, time to stop. But then we see the ones with 30, 40, 50, 60. It's hard work. You've got to be meaning what you're doing.
But it's like multiple stab wounds, isn't it? You know,
yes.
You know, somebody who intended to stab somebody once because of rage and anger and hate and fear, but then when you find, post-mortem says they were stabbed 47 times, there is that rage that happens, that bloodlust rage. And I think You know, there's something very emotional about blunt force.
I mean, how often, Stuart, can you not tell the instrument that was used? Because, you know, it's nowhere to be seen. It's at the bottom of a lake and somebody's asking, a police officer's asking you, can you tell? And you're just looking at the marks.
It's not uncommon that if you simply have non-specific bruising, a few little splits to the skin, then you are saying this is what we call non-specific blunt trauma, so it doesn't point you to an implement. Those cases where you do get the footwear mark, the thing that shows up on an alternative light source, are, you know, a real bingo moment in an investigation. So it's not uncommon that it's simply a beating, not otherwise specified. And certainly with the one punch, you will often see maybe a little bruise on the front of the face that's in keeping with the punch, a damage to the back of the head in keeping with hitting the ground, and that's probably about as far as you can take it.
Well, I think this has been absolutely a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, Stuart, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Linda, I mean, well, you've written your book, Blunt Force. We know all about it. We're going to write a book about every episode in this series, are we?
Yes, definitely. It's so, well, I just learn something every time, you know. And that's why I think, you know, Stuart's been wonderful, because I've learned so much from him.
As long as I get credit in the next novel.
Definitely. We'll have to think up the plot. I think we had a few plot lines here today. Yeah. Somebody dying 17 years after being hit is one to look out for, I think. Linda, Kaz, pleasure as always. And we'll be back episode 2 next week. Look out for it. Otherwise, in the meantime, please look at Linda's website, lindalaplante.com, where you can find out all the information you need about the upcoming episodes and previous episodes in Listening to the Dead. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you haven't done so already, then please subscribe to the series on whatever platform you're listening now. We'll be back next week with episode 2. Here's a clip.
The detonators they use to detonate that main charge were what we call PATP. This is why they have to wear masks. It causes a vapour, which then, as it solidifies again, it will fall onto the floor in very, very small crystal forms. But it was found that when you walk on these things, they actually go pop as they're exploding under your feet, which was quite disconcerting.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books UK.
CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event, is coming to London, June 2021. Get inside the mind of serial killers and psychopaths. Learn from leading criminologists. Hear from the families and survivors. Meet your favorite true crime podcasters. Immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. CrimeCon is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered by Crime and Investigation. I will be there, as will Cass, so come and join us. Quote Bonnier, that is Bonnier, to claim a 10% discount. Limited tickets are on sale now. No need to worry, organisers are offering full refund or transfer if the virus still causes us bother in June. For more information, visit crimecon.co.uk. See you there!